Welcome to Progression Health Podcast. I'm here with Milad Edebat, or Tailored Fit PT. I hope I pronounced your name right, Milad. Do you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, of course. Hey, how's it going, everybody? My name is Milad. I am a kinesiologist, I like to say. For those of you who are like, what the hell is a kinesiologist? A great question. Basically, a kinesiologist is someone who is an expert in human movement across all disciplines and all domains. I have rejected a personal trainer title because I think that we are more than that. We can be better than that. Obviously, if you're just a personal trainer, that's true. But for those of you like, who is this like dingus that calls himself a kinesiologist? Like, I'm a kinesiologist. I have a degree in kinesiology. And the reason I like to introduce myself as a kinesiologist is because in my own coaching and my own frameworks, I like to use movement as the center of philosophy of different disciplines. So whether that be psychology, philosophy, exercise science, muscle mechanics, biomechanics, whatever, movement is in the center of that. And we pick and we bring things from other domains because I truly believe that's what you need in order to be a good coach and in order to help people with movement. That's me. I'm a kinesiologist. I've been doing it for, it's almost probably 10 years now. So I started out as a physical therapy aide while I was getting my kinesiology degree. I did that for several years. And then I went into personal training. I was working in a boutique gym under a couple other coaches, just one of the personal trainers there. I did that for a few years. And I was lucky enough to start my own business and do my own thing. And now I do in-person training. I have a remote coaching business that we do through Tailored Fit PT. And then I also have an app and other things that we're putting out. Yeah, mainly working with, I would just say, everyday folks. Anyone between the ages of 21 up to like 70, basically. Mostly people that have a 9-to-5 job, that have kids, that have other commitments and are trying to get healthy through fitness, through nutrition, through mental health stuff. That's kind of our bread and butter. And yeah, we just kind of simplify it. So we have a very big foundation, science, peer-reviewed literature, knowledge, experience, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, my job is to make all that super simple and curate it to the person in front of me to help them get healthy and happy.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's a really thorough overview. Expert in kinesiology. You know, what do you kind of enjoy most about being focused or centered around kinesiology? And, you know, what's your kind of, maybe like your bread and butter, your specialty?
I mean, it kind of changes, but I think right now it's kind of like the intersection between like strength, mobility, therapeutic exercise, and then and cardio, I guess, for right now. And I know that's a bunch of different things, but I guess because we do a lot of general population stuff, over my years of experience, I truly believe you need to be very good at all of those things in order to help the person in front of you. So yeah, mobility, strength, cardio, stability, therapeutic exercise, stuff like that.
I totally agree that you need to be an all-rounded kind of athlete in a way, or whatever word you want to choose, fitness practitioner. What is most important if you look at health and movement as strength training, vascular work, and mobility, if those are the big three, if you think there's more, what do you think is like the most important or like the most underrated of those three?
I would honestly say cardiovascular health. And I say this to my clients all the time who hate cardio. And it's like, honestly, like to be honest with you, like the lowest hanging fruit to help you improve your health or if you want to live longer is to just increase your cardiovascular capacity. That's the biggest thing. And it just helps in so many other domains. There's a bunch of studies out there. They do like the A-B testing, right? So it's like there's two groups, both beginners. They're going to throw them into some sort of hypertrophy intervention, right? Of resistance training, however many weeks. But the first group does cardiovascular intervention for 4 to 8 weeks. And then they both start. The group that has a better cardio base always has more muscle gain. It's a lot easier for them. And that's just because it's such a complementary thing to your just like organism, right? So like you're increasing your mitochondria, you're increasing your capillary density, you're increasing your work capacity. So it just makes it that much easier to build mobility and to build strength. Cardio for sure. I know that might be scary for some folks.
Yeah, the amount of people who just, oh, I don't enjoy cardio. I would totally agree. It's like, I don't enjoy cardio, but I enjoy when I'm in it or benefits that come after the fact. Focus on that, the benefits they get after they get into it. That would help a lot. Milad, you mentioned you started off as PT aide and you do a lot of work with mobility now, which I assume ties into kind of injury. What was it that didn't appeal to you about being a physical therapist and how does it look now? Do you ever think about being a physical therapist given the work you do around mobility and does that tie into injury as well?
I think the only reason I didn't become a physical therapist was because of my financial situation. In the United States, there has been a saturation of physical therapy programs, obviously with our university system being the way that it is. mostly profit driven. These programs cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and you have to take out loans with high interest rates. I wasn't in a place. I worked my ass off in college to get myself through college and I didn't want to put on another like $250,000 worth of loans. So that was honestly the biggest thing. And yes, I do work with mobility. We do a lot of like therapeutic exercises with our clients. I like to say that we do, or what I do and what my philosophy is that we bridge the gap between physical therapy and strength and condition coach. Let's say you tear a rotator cuff, you either get it surgically repaired or you do whatever, a 12 to 24 week physical therapy conservative intervention. And then it heals, banded stuff and some mobility work, just light stuff. It works. That's great. Pain's gone. And then they're like, all right, have fun. That's it. We're not going to help you anymore because we can't. What ends up happening is she's like, all right, I'm going to go and start training like I used to. Maybe they're loading up the barbell or they're going overhead and their capacity is not there. Our job is to be like, all right, you're done with physical therapy. Let's keep you going so that you can basically turn into that athlete or just go overhead with no problem or get you as strong as possible. And I do believe that there is a little phase there because when I was being educated as a coach or strength and conditioning, it's, oh, like if there's any type of injury or any type of pathology occurring, then you have to refer out. You always have to refer out. And that comes from a great place, understandably so, but I think that there is another area there as a coach or as a kinesiologist. If you understand the underlying principles of injury, which is totally in your scope of practice to educate yourself and to understand these rehab protocols. And it's like, okay, what have they been doing? Now, what can I give them to really make them resilient and make them super strong in that strength and conditioning lens? So that's kind of where we're at. And I'm actually just trying to figure out the best way to communicate that because I believe a lot of people can benefit from that. And I don't know if I would go back to become a physical therapist unless I come across a bunch of money where I can take 3 years off and pay for it and still invest and stuff like that, which who knows, maybe knock on wood. But as of right now, I'm focusing on that middle ground just to educate myself on like rehab principles, but also on strength and conditioning principles. And then also how can we go from, okay, you're done with conservative care. Let's turn you into a beast. Let's turn you into a freaking resilient thing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting like hybrid approach and niche that you're tapping into. And I feel like you can help a lot of people who get great results with physical therapy, but then it's kind of like they lack the strength component and kind of vice versa. So yeah, that's a really interesting take. You mentioned best way people can increase or improve their health is increasing their physical activity, their cardiovascular health. You know, what are some tips that you typically recommend to a new client who doesn't do any cardio? Or maybe even if they're just like, I'm not down for cardio. Cardio is just not my jam. I'm going to stick to the weights. I'm going to stick to yoga, for example. How do you work with a client like that?
If that is really the case where cardio is not the jam and they're not going to do it, then what we're going to do is just start with any type of movement that they're comfortable doing and make sense for them and their life. I'm never one to project my own goals onto my clients or the person in front of me. It's like, hey, okay, if you don't want to do cardio, that's fine. Let's just start 12 weeks of doing a little bit of yoga and a little bit of resistance training. Let's track our progress along the way. And then if we're consistent and you're feeling good and you see results, I guarantee you by the end of week 12, you'll be like, hey, I just did something that I didn't think that I could ever achieve. And I did it consistently for 12 weeks. Now I think I'm ready for maybe a little bit of cardio. And I know that I'm going to hate it initially, but I'm just going to try it. So that's how I go about that. I'm never one to be like, you have to do cardio. If you don't do cardio, we're not going to work together. It's like, no, it's just start moving, you know, get some steps in, maybe just bump up the incline on the treadmill and then go from there. And then along the process, just like educating them on the importance of cardio. It's like, okay, you're doing the yoga, you're doing resistance. Great. Let me tell you why I think you should be doing the cardio. We do a lot of goal setting. I guess it's like mindfulness stuff when it comes to like our consultation process. So like one thing that we really like to do is understanding people's deeper whys. It's called like the five why practices, right? So most people, they come to train with us because, you know, they're just trying to get healthier, lose some weight, maybe work around their knee pain or their lower back pain. And it's always like, okay, like why do you want to, you know, work around your knee pain? And it's like, oh, because it's uncomfortable and I can't lift weights like I would. It's like, okay, why do you want to lift weights? Like, oh, well, I want to build muscle. Well, because, you know, I want to feel good about myself. Like fifth why is kind of like a philosophical answer. So it's like, maybe it has something to do with spirituality or your family. It's like, I want to be around with my kids and be able to like hang with them and pick them up on the playground. Or I want to just live longer to be around for my parents, my community, whatever, my coworkers. So establishing that deeper why, you know, grab their intrinsic motivators. And then we just kind of play off of that. So it's like, once you hit week 12, like, hey, you know, remember when you told me like 12 weeks ago, you want to be able to play with your kids when they're older? Well, it's like your VO2 max is in that great. And in order to play with your kids, we need to bump that up. And here's how we do it. And there's always a way to introduce a modality that people are going to like. I love running, but I know most people hate running. And I know you're a runner too. You love running. We're addicted to it. We're fiends. I hate running. It's like, okay, like hop on the rower or do some Tabata, do some jump rope, go walk, go on a hike. That stuff all works too.
So yeah, if someone was to start working with you and they're just not into the cardio, is it just a case that you can find another alternative that fits that person? Like they don't have to do running? Because I feel like a lot of the times with clients myself, they have this kind of like fixed view or sort of black and white where it's like, I'm not doing that thing and that's it. Is it a lot of like modification to meet the client where they're at and try and like do the Tabata, is that a part of your work with clients?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I always tell people there's a million ways to do any exercise, right? And there's probably not a million ways, but there's a lot. So yeah, it's like, if you don't like running, that's fine. Let's try the bike. If you don't like biking, that's fine. Let's try the rower. If you don't like rowing, let's do swimming. If you don't like swimming, go on a hike. Hiking, do some like intense walking. If you don't like walking, jumper. I mean, there's just so many different ways to do it. And yeah, like you mentioned, that all or nothing thinking or that black and white thinking, that's also another thing we really deal with. And I think it's very prominent in most folks' kind of like mindset. It's just like, yeah, if I can't do this, then I'm never going to do it. There's gray areas and there's never just one answer. There's usually multiple outputs.
Yeah, exactly. Because people are so different and diverse. I think, yeah, we can really modify things a lot, maybe not a million ways. You mentioned tracking progress. Why do you focus on that? How does that look when a client starts and after a couple of weeks? And why is that important?
You know, I think tracking progress is very motivating. And it's also very, it can help you just overcome some insecurities or obstacles. That's, I think, the biggest use case for coaches is it's a way to motivate your clients and to just kind of bring them back down if they ever feel anxious or feel sad about lack of progress being made, because it's really hard in the first couple of weeks. But like just tracking volume is super, it's like such an easy way to show an accumulation of strength or some sort of neurological adaptation, right? And you don't have to lift heavy. It's just like, yo, you did like 3 more reps on the bent over row than you did last week. That is progress. It's the math. Look at the chart. It's super easy. So that's kind of the biggest thing. It's a motivator. It keeps people going. And especially like if you have some sort of body composition goal, sometimes, you know, if you are only tracking your body weight, and that's a recipe for disaster. So you should also be tracking like volume lifted, maybe body circumferences, qualitative indicators of success too, like taking pictures or how your clothes fit. Those are super important.
Can you just talk a little bit more about if somebody has like a fat loss goal, for example, which is a common one with clients I work with, all those other metrics you mentioned, because fat loss is the easy one just to jump on the scale every morning, for example, but there's a lot more to it than just the scale. And I think you kind of alluded to that a little bit.
Yeah, when it comes to fat loss, yeah, I mean, it could be a while before you see any changes on the scale, or you see some crazy overnight fluctuations and you're like, what the hell, man? So basically, for example,
can you put some numbers to like the time it takes for a scale to move or the fluctuations?
So generally speaking, like a rate of sustainable fat loss, or let's say not even fat loss, let's just talk about body weight, a rate of consistent body weight, sustainable body weight change in a month, you want to shoot for anything between 0.5 to 2 pounds a month. That's a nice pace for us because it allows time for our metabolism to kind of catch up with that loss. It's also not too extreme of a caloric deficit where we're feeling tired throughout the day or cognitively having issues or even having some hormonal issues from the caloric restriction. If you are making this lifestyle change and you are expecting a 1 pound drop every day, that is very, very unsustainable. Now, what you might find is like a 3 pound increase overnight if you had more carbs than you usually do, or you just had some more water, or you didn't go to the bathroom. There's so many variables in play there. When you have other metrics, so you have body circumference, you have the way you fit in your clothes, pictures, volume lifted, that is a lot better because you'll obviously see volume increase within like 2 weeks, sometimes week by week. Circumference stuff is a little bit slower, but you'll probably see some changes over a week period as well. So that's kind of where it's important, because body weight's just going to fluctuate and you really need like a 6 month timeline to really see it, because weight loss is very rarely just linear down into the right. It's usually just like peaks and valleys and some plateaus. And I always, you know, we always just talk about, don't even really worry about weight loss. Let's talk about just fat loss, because sometimes weight loss is unhealthy. And sometimes we want to lose fat and we want to gain muscle, especially for beginners, right? When you gains, it's very easy to recomp as a fully unadapted individual. And what might happen is you're like eating very clean and you're resistance training consistently, and then your weight goes up in a month and you're like, what the heck? I'm not seeing any results. Like, no, you actually gained like more muscle than you lost fat. And that happens too. If you do have access to a DEXA scan, just get a DEXA scan. That makes everyone's lives easier. But I know those are expensive and not everyone has access to those. So yeah, that's the thought process there.
Great. Yeah. So there's just basically a lot more to fat loss than just the scale. Something you mentioned earlier was, you know, the five questions and a little bit on mental health. Can you just talk a little bit about like the work that you do with the client where maybe there's a conversation that comes up around mental health, or maybe how you kind of try to foster a good mental state or good mindset with the client?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we're always talking about mindset when it comes to any type of behavior change or any type of goal setting, things like that. First off, it's always talking about how this is a lifestyle change and not just a diet or not just a fitness challenge where you're doing something for 12 weeks and then you stop. We have to, at the end of whatever our protocol is, get you in a place where you're like, oh, this is part of me. This is part of my identity. This is what I do. We always just remind people when we're first starting, it's like, okay, this is a lifestyle change. It's not a diet. It's not 75 hard. This is just something that you're going to start doing. And I know it sounds weird, but you will. So a couple things to mention. It's like, okay, you need to change the way you talk to yourself. You have to cultivate this identity of someone that eats healthy and someone that works out most of the time. For example of that is like, hey, when it's like Wednesday night, middle of the week, you know, you're not supposed to really have any treat meals, but it's like after dinner, everything's been going great so far, but you have that sugar craving and you're, oh man, I just want that pint of Ben and Jerry's. What you can do in that situation is be like, I am someone that has the identity that instead of having a pint of Ben and Jerry's Wednesday night at 9 p.m., I'm going to have some strawberries or some frozen fruit or some substitute ice cream with protein, right? Because that's going to help me sleep better. And then that's going to help me wake up in the morning and work out. And that's just you internally talking to yourself and establishing that identity is so big. And there's a bunch of studies that back this up, but let's forget about that. So that's one thing we do. As you mentioned before, we try to steer people away and call out the all or nothing mindset or a black and white mindset or a perfectionist mindset. So that's a big thing that pops up amongst all clients. And it's part of the human condition, honestly. Even someone that coaches it, I get that all the time. And I have to walk myself away. It's like, oh, this is black or white thinking. This is all or nothing thinking. So just stop and just think about other outcomes instead of just the one that you're perceiving. And I'm trying to think of some other examples when it comes to mental health. And it's like, yeah, you got to understand, it's like, this is a marathon, not a sprint. There will absolutely be days where you're unmotivated and you maybe think that you're weak or you're unfit or whatever. You know, just note them as the emotions that's part of the process, and then just be like, I love myself. I'm going to move on. I'm going to act. So usually when you have those icky feelings, the best way to get rid of them is to acknowledge them and to act in the opposite direction. So if you feel unfit or you feel weak, just get your workout in and be like, all right, I acknowledge that I am feeling unstrong or weak right now, and that's okay. I'm at the start of my journey. I am going to go to the gym and crush this workout regardless, and I'm going to check my little app that shows me my volume lifted, and I know that I'm getting stronger.
Great. Yeah, I love the opposite action idea. That's and acting as well, getting into action are two big ones I use myself. So with black and white thinking and perfectionism, with mobility, nutrition, exercise, maybe you have some relevant examples on hand. What's the issue? Because perfectionism, oh, I'm going to do something really well, would be the case for it. And then with black and white thinking, I could think of like, yeah, it just simplifies my approach. So it's got a lot of utility. What would you say to someone who is thinking along those lines?
Well, just the overall concept. I mean, sometimes having a very straightforward outcome-oriented goal is okay and appropriate. I think for general population clients that are just starting out on their fitness journey, it's not appropriate because things can just go wrong. An example of, let's just say black and white thinking. So let's talk about someone like that has a fat loss goal and they're like, hey, by the end of 12 weeks, I want to have lost 8 pounds just of body weight, right? So it's a very concrete 8 pounds. And let's say they work their butt off, they're eating clean, they're resistance training, they're doing everything right for 12 weeks. And then the last day of that 12th week comes up, they step on the scale and they lost 7 pounds instead of 8. Because you are so fixated on that number of 8, when you hit 7, you feel like you completely failed. And it deflates all of the progress you made in the 12 weeks. And more likely than not, you lose all motivation. You're like, you know what? I just worked my butt off and I didn't hit my goal. So I'm just going to quit. There's no point. There's no point to this. I wasn't rewarded with what I wanted. on it. But if you set a more realistic goal, it's like, hey, my goal by the end of week 12 is a weight loss goal of anywhere between 4 to 8 pounds. So you give yourself a spectrum so that we're already moving away from the black and white thinking. Now, I also want a goal of resistance training twice a week for the next 12 weeks and getting an average of 6,000 steps per day. So again, we're acting again, and we have these process-oriented goals instead of just the one outcome-oriented goal. And it's very easy, you know, because a workout can be almost anything, right? It doesn't have to be an hour long. It could just be 15 minutes, get the compound sets in and get the hell out of there. That's where not having a black and white or very outcome-oriented approach is going to make the difference. Because, you know, once you get to the 12 week, at the end of that 12 weeks, you've maybe gotten somewhere in between the 4 to 8 pounds of fat loss, and you feel motivated, like, all right, let's do another 12 weeks and set more realistic goals and let's go from there.
Yeah, it's like having a mindset that works for you as opposed to sort of working against you or undermining you. So yeah, that sounds very effective. So we're sitting down and we're probably going to feel a little bit tight after this. So one of your really interesting posts was on alleviating the tightness we get from sitting, especially you're like kind of like a knowledge worker working from home. You're sitting all day. You know, what are some mobility exercises or, you know, things people can do when they're working from home or sitting down a lot to stay mobile?
So usually, like when it comes to just sitting all day, I like to just talk about like shoulders, mid back and hips. Usually just moving your shoulders, moving your back into extension, rotation, flexion. And then definitely your hips into extension at a bare minimum. So specific exercises, if I had to pick like three, one for the shoulder, one for the back, and one for the hip. So like for the shoulders, I would probably do a elevated lat stretch with like an external rotation bias. So basically it's like you put your elbows on a bench or a couch, and then your torso is parallel to the ground. And then you fold your forearms onto your biceps, and then you push your thumbs away from each other. That's the external rotation bias. So you're targeting your rotator cuffs and stretching out the lats, which is literally the opposite of the hunchback posture. When it comes to like the mid back, I would just do a kind of like kneeling quadruped rotation or an open book, just so we can get that rotational movement opening things up. And then when it comes to the hips, gold standard, like couch stretch is like the best stretch you can do for your hips, just because it kind of pulls you back into extension, which is the opposite of flexion, which we're sitting in flexion all day when it comes to sitting all day. So that's the biggest thing. And just moving and changing posture. Like there's no such thing as a bad posture. It's just how long you spend time in that posture. So you can be upright and tuck your chin in and just be this like, you know, absolute unit of a posture person. But if you do that for like 5 hours, you're going to have issues that develop. The biggest thing is to just move, just change your position, go kneeling, go half kneeling, lay down.
Yeah, just move. I love that. So how does the cardiovascular work and the resistance training fit in with the mobility? Somebody sits a lot, you know, how do they kind of figure out how much they need to do of those three if they feel tight? Would mobility be the focus for someone who sits a lot and is tight, or how do you kind of figure that one out?
Yeah, I mean, if it's like someone that's absolute beginner, so yeah, like mobility, cardio, and resistance training, it's all going to be part of it. I would just start with a goal of like at least 5,000 steps a day. So that's gonna be kind of our like quote unquote cardio element. It's not necessarily like going to be enough to get your heart rate up, but for the first 4 weeks, it's more than enough, especially if you're super busy. 5,000 steps per day. It's not the 10,000. We're going to ramp up to 10,000 because 10,000 is a lot. So you start there. Mobility wise, again, targeting mid back, shoulders, and your hips goes a long way. 10 minutes is really all you need when you're first starting, 10, 11 minutes. And then resistance training, 25 minutes of just compound exercises, depending on where you're at, right? So if you have a lot of mobility restrictions and you have pain, you need to modify that. And that happens on a case by case basis. It depends on what your issue is, but you can 100% resistance train, and that's going to be great for you too, because just stretching by itself it's good. It's not bad, but it's not the complete picture. And sometimes your perception of pain, or if you feel pain, it's not necessarily that your muscles are tight. It could also mean that the joint is unstable, or the muscle itself is just weak and it's compensating for weakness, or there's some sort of asymmetry occurring that's causing the tightness. And that's why we have to take that more holistic approach in order to solve some of these issues.
So if somebody primarily does yoga, or they lift, or they run, are you saying that that's not enough?
Yeah, if you're only just doing yoga, it's not enough. If you're only just lifting, it's not enough. If you're only just doing cardio, it's not enough. Or if we're focusing on longevity and just overall health, you want to live longer, and then you want to function better and be happy while living longer, then yeah, you have to do more. You have to incorporate like mobility training, cardio, and all that stuff. And it doesn't have to be a lot. It just has to be more, a little bit more than you're used to.
Yeah, to get that all-around health. Focusing more specifically on the hips, you have a 10-minute hip mobility routine. The video you posted is for it to be done every day. but how does someone decide how much they need to do if they have tight hips, how much they need to do? And once they kind of figure out a sort of like schedule, can they start to like do less over time? Or is it, you know, they do it 3 times a week and they have to stick with that into the future? Or, you know, how does that work with the frequency?
I mean, it honestly depends. It depends on the person, really. And I know that's a cop-out answer, but there's so many variables involved in how people perceive their tightness. So it's hard to be like, yes, no. I would say generally speaking, I mean, it's good to just like go through those drills at least once a day, or if you can come up with your own custom one. Like there, we have a couple different assessments, hip assessments that shows like, okay, like your hip rotators are tight or your posterior chain is tight. And sometimes like, you know, your hip flexors may be tight, but your posterior chain isn't tight. So then you probably aren't going to focus on the part that isn't tight because you're good there. It really depends. One thing that I do know is like, okay, so if you are an extremely tight person and you stretch every day and then you hit the baseline kind of flexibility mobility standards, once you start training full range of motion, strength training in certain positions, that's kind of enough to keep you out of the stretching or the mobility. So that you can basically like expedite your mobility and flexibility by going full range of motion strength training. But usually what people need is like most people can't just hop into a full ROM, you know, ass to grass, almost goblet squat. Most people can't do that, whether that be because it's a motor learning thing or because it's a mobility restriction thing or just like a strength thing. You can't do that. And that's one of the biggest rebuttals I get, like, because I do a lot of mobility and stretching content. It's like, oh, you don't need to stretch. You don't need to do mobility. Just do full range of motion strength training. And it's like, yeah, I mean, sure. But like, good luck telling Aunt Susie to go ass to grass with a barbell on her back when she hasn't even walked 1,000 steps in the past 30 days. It's contextual, and I get where that's all coming from. That's great. But my philosophy is that just ease into it. Once you get that foundational level of flexibility and mobility, start training full range of motion. It's going to feel nice. It's going to feel great. You're going to crave it. And then you have to do less to kind of maintain.
So you're saying it's not an either or, mobility or strength training or even cardiovascular work. They're kind of like synergistic. They all work together.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, because it's kind of like you think you do one and you have to do, like, you have to prioritize it. But if they all work together, then it's like you don't have to overdo it on any one of them. Another post you had, Milad, was on knees. So I actually have, I don't know, do people call it runner's knee, but I have a little bit of soreness walking downstairs at the front of my knee. And I'm starting to realize that's pretty common. Have you heard of this particular pain? How common is knee pain in general? And then, you know, how do you help people with knee pain?
Yeah, I mean, that's like a very, very common issue, like front of the knee pain, especially going down or up steps. And it, I mean, it could be a couple of different things. You know, it's like either patellofemoral syndrome or something with your patella tendon, things like that. My goal is to help them train around that pain. And usually when you're training around that pain, you talk in therapeutic exercises just to basically like strengthen the surrounding tissue. And just with more movement will help the healing process, and people will tend to see a decrease in pain, especially if it's like a low amount, like anywhere between 3 to 5, not like an 8 or a 10. So usually my process with that is like, okay, first off, assess your hip mobility. You have good hip mobility. If so, you can skip the hip mobility stuff. If not, then you got to improve your hip mobility. And that's just kind of like a biomechanic thing, right? So if you have restrictions in range of motion at your hips or your ankles, then the force running through your knees are going to increase because the force distribution isn't that great. Sometimes they're called like energy leaks. Ankle mobility, check your ankle mobility. Then just all around, strengthen the crap out of your quads, your glutes, your hamstrings, your calves, your tibs. In a way, while you're strengthening them, they don't flare your knees up. If you have front of the knee pain, you want to increase strength in your hip flexors or your quads. I probably wouldn't have you doing a Bulgarian split squat right out the gate. For the first 4 weeks, we're just doing very simple stuff. Maybe it is knee extensions on the machine, lightweight, high reps. Maybe we're doing Spanish squats. Maybe which are basically like quarter squat isometric holds. Maybe we're just doing like 90 degree knee isometrics. For glutes, we're doing sideline hip abduction. Usually people can handle like hip thrusts and things like that, but not reverse lunges. That's kind of the approach. So it's like a mobility thing. It's a modification of exercises that are flaring the knee up. And then it's also adding in therapeutic exercises that are typically working on the joint stabilizers and then overall gross strength of the tissue surrounding the knee.
So you take like a comprehensive, holistic approach to whatever the issue is with the client. Is that your approach?
Yeah, exactly. And then it's very important to just progress too. So like, I'm not going to just stop at like Spanish squats. So once your knee's feeling better and you're going downstairs, the knee's feeling a lot better, then then maybe we're doing some like heel elevated step downs, and maybe we're just loading up the knee extensions more. It's all always about that progressive overload, because at the end of the day, the goal is to build resilience in that tissue or in that joint so that it ideally doesn't happen again. Obviously, like, you can't prevent injury, all that stuff, blah, 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 but you can really mitigate against it for sure.
Yeah, injury and then kind of pain, they kind of go together. That's something I want to talk about as well. So how common is it that you yourself or with clients, they experience pain or injury when training, and how do you handle the situation?
During training, it's pretty rare. Like, I haven't really had too many clients get injured during a session, but definitely maybe like sometimes after someone has like a back spasm or their knees are extra tender. I usually just try to explain to them what pain is, and it's pain is a signal from your nervous system. Sometimes it has nothing to do with the actual structures of your body, with the actual muscles or the tendons or ligaments. Sometimes it does, and you just have to kind of be a little bit patient. So if it's like an acute thing, you know, I usually just tell them like, hey, just chill out on it a little bit. If it's really bad, obviously go see like your practitioner or go to an urgent care. It's never really been that bad. Explaining what pain is to people, and then also telling them like, hey, like, our goal isn't to fully eradicate pain. It's like impossible. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you just live with pain or soreness or something, and that's okay. So yeah, the education there is big.
If someone was to have like a flare up, a spasm, just in my experience, like lower back pain, for example, and as you already said, it's like pain's unavoidable. So like, it does happen sometimes. What's kind of like the next step? Let's say someone worked out, they have a little bit of back pain. What can they do next?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a little bit of back pain, I would just be like, yeah, you know, you're going to feel it for a little bit. Just wait until the inflammation decreases and chill. If it's a lot where they're like, can't walk or can't bend or be functional, I would just tell them to, if they need to, they just go to your general practitioner, or go to the urgent care. Because we're still, even like more acute traumatic stuff, that's not really something that we are inept enough to like work on or help with. So I always kind of refer out in that situation. But if it's just like very mild, that's totally okay. Where it's like, hey, you know, my knees are sore after the walking lunge. It's like, oh yeah, don't worry about it. If it's still a thing in a couple days, let me know. But usually that's never the case.
Yeah. There's ways to manage it and to work around it. You mentioned progression, and you had a really nice post of you training your parents, and you know, they earned their progression. How do you coach your parents? How does that work? And how do they progress their training being a little bit older than you and I?
Yeah, I train them on and off. Like, I've written a couple programs that they just do by themselves at this point. In terms of, what was the question? It's like, you train your parents, and then what was the other thing?
So it's kind of twofold. Is, you know, they've earned their progression into doing more challenging exercises. And also, how does the training look, you know, now that they're a little bit older than you and I? Like, how does it differ?
Yeah, it's like relatively, one thing we're not really doing is like barbell back squats. High risk, low reward for them. I mean, I've always actually just never really even been that big of a fan of barbell back squats. Maybe because I have long femurs and they've just always felt so uncomfortable for me. But yeah, things like barbell back squats, I'm probably not doing with them. More so doing like goblet squats, front loading the weight distribution that we're still deadlifting. It's basically like the same stuff. Maybe we're just modifying, picking it up from a higher surface or something like that. But the goal is to just like have them training and doing things in full range of motion. And I think like most people can get there with maybe some modification. So yeah, they train like anywhere between 1 to 3 times a week, but they're also very active with like hiking and biking and cardio. So they're big on cardio and they do mobility like every day. So that's kind of what they're doing. And that's kind of the longevity kind of formula, right? Two to four resistance training sessions, 3 to 4 cardio, be outside kind of thing, and then mobility every day or every other day. And yeah, I always just tell them to, you know, increase the weight when appropriate. But we also got them in for like DEXA scans, and their bone density is high, their muscle mass is high. It's in the upper percentile for both things. The biggest thing for them is visceral fat. And that's more of like a nutrition protocol, which we're working on. The things that you would typically be focused on with older folks, which is the muscle mass and lean muscle mass, and then bone density is already covered, which is great. So next is to address the visceral fat issue.
Yeah, the nutrition side of things is a whole other.
Yeah,
do you do much nutritional work with clients? What kind of, like, I guess, kind of mindset or tips do you have for anyone with their nutrition if they are facing any challenges?
I mean, yeah, we do nutrition work with our clients. We do just general nutrition coaching. So just helping people out with, if they are tracking calories and macros, just figuring out what the best strategy is for that, giving them some numbers, holding them accountable, and then also educating them on like what they should be eating. So we always just follow like an 80-20 rule. So 80% of the time you're eating minimally processed, nutrient dense meals. And then 20% of the time you have your treat meals. We like to do that just so it's like more sustainable, because in our culture, like food is kind of centerpiece of a lot of social outings and social meetings. And your social life is actually a big part of your health. We're never about like, hey, yeah, just stay home instead of going out with your friends or your family and stuff like that. It's like, no. We got to make sure we're scheduling that in. So we figure out a way to do that. And just with everything in our coaching, our approach to nutrition is just like, keep it very simple and progress and progress. Go about it in the path of least resistance, make it custom to the person in front of them. And, you know, obviously avoid the black and white thinking. I think the biggest advice that I would have if someone's just trying to eat healthier is like, you know, make sure you're getting some lean protein with every meal and eat the rainbow. So have some veggies, have some fruit, kind of go from there.
So something I experienced myself personally with exercise is that when I'm exercising, I naturally want to make better food choices. Is this something, do you try and tie the exercise in with the nutrition, or do you experience that yourself or with clients?
I mean, I definitely experience that myself. Yeah. If I'm consistently exercising, I'm eating healthier. And yeah, that we're always drawing lines between different modalities. So like if you exercise earlier in the day, the likelihood of you adhering to your nutrition protocol is way higher. Because like, hey, I already did my workout. I put in some effort to move in the right direction for my health. I'm not going to be eating this calorically dense processed food for lunch because A, it's going to drain me of the energy I got from the workout, but B, it's just going to kind of erase all the work I did low key. Yeah. I mean, I always love making that connection too. And clients usually just have that observation too, which I always love hearing from them.
And then how big of a part of your approach to like exercise and also the nutrition is like kind of modifying and being flexible? Because, you know, just life is full of so many different challenges. Like for example, the social setting, try and stick to your macros when you're at a family gathering, it's quite tricky, or to get your steps in can be different. How do you kind of add that into your coaching?
Yeah. So the biggest part of that is just planning and preparing, you know, making sure we see those obstacles or those challenges ahead at least by a week. So it's like, hey, next weekend I have a baby shower and I know that there's just going to be an awesome charcuterie board there and I'm probably not going to be moving too much. So it's like, all right, that's fine. That's our treat day. Make sure you get all your workouts in before that. And ideally on the day of, you can maybe go get some steps in or maybe do something active or whatever. It's not hard to solve these problems. It's just something that you have to plan and prepare for. And with our coaching system, we're always checking in on that. Like every check-in we have at the start of the week is like, hey, what are some obstacles and challenges that might be coming up on the horizon, and let's plan for them. And then flexibility is huge, and making sure you're not on that rigid kind of structure or protocol is going to help too. If I was one of those coaches that were like, no fruit, can't have any fruit because it's bad for you, you're smoking bullshit, then my client goes to like a baby shower and there's like fruit, it's either they pick between fruit or just some processed calorically dense thing. They're going to pick the other thing because they have this restriction or whatever. So I always steer clear of dogmas or restrictive stuff. If people like that, if they're like, hey, actually, like I like having certain constraints around my training and my nutrition, we'll apply those as long as they're healthy constraints. You know, if someone's like, an example of an unhealthy constraint, it's like, I only want to have 1,000 calories per day. It's like, well, good luck finding a coach that'll deem that ethical. You know, we can't work together. There's no way you're only going to have 1,000 calories per day. It's kind of the flexibility thing.
And then just with the planning. So I know myself, I get a lot of like benefit out of planning. It just saves from like decision fatigue where I make poor decisions like on the fly. How do you kind of work that into your coaching? And, you know, if someone's just like, oh, I'll just figure it out on the day, they're like not convinced. What would you say to someone like that?
Like if they're like, hey, I don't want to plan and prepare.
Yeah, I don't have the time. I'm too busy.
That's an issue with them. You know, if they're unwilling to actually plan and prepare and work within the constraints of our coaching, then it's like, it's not going to work. It's like saying like, okay, yeah, I want to save money, but I can't save money. Well, it's like, okay, like there's an issue with the language here, right? You're working in a land of la la land. You know, it's, I'm sorry, if you're not going to take 5 minutes to sit down with me to plan and prepare and you're like, hey, I'm just going to wing it. Then it's like, all right, well, the outcome is going to be failure more than likely. And it's like you as a coach sometimes have to draw the line in the sand. It's like, hey, you know, like obviously flexibility is great and sustainability is great and motivational interviewing and being friendly and accommodating is great up into a certain point where that starts hurting your client. And that's our philosophy. There's other coaches that work in a different way, but it's like, you know, there's some non-negotiables that we have in order for us to work together. And if you're unwilling to plan and prepare for things, then it's probably not going to work out. And I think that's an important thing. You know, I don't know if there's like coaches listening to this, you have to be willing to draw the line in the sand, to say no, and to actually coach and be like, hey, with all due respect, this is not the right approach. And here's why. And you get that through confidence and through knowledge and experience, obviously. But I think as a as a young coach, when I was first starting out, I would just bend over backwards for anything a client wanted. A client's like, oh, I don't like resting 90 seconds after my squats. I just want to keep going. I want to do HIIT. I'm like, oh yeah, we'll do HIIT. And it's like after 12 weeks of just doing HIIT workouts, they weren't increasing their weights because they're freaking exhausted, or they're like, hey, I'm so tired and sore. And not saying that HIIT, there's nothing wrong with it. It's not. But it depends.
Non-negotiables, Milad. What non-negotiables do you have for yourself, or do you see that work well for clients?
Yeah, I mean, for myself and clients, it's different because we're both in different places in our journey. So for clients, non-negotiables, again, being open to, well, okay, first things first is to just take on a growth mindset versus a fix. So the growth mindset is basically a mindset, it's very broad, where understand that you are a thing, a person, organism, human that is capable of change, right? You're not fixed in space. If you were to do exercise, you will get better, and you're open and you're flexible. So they have to have the growth mindset over the fix. Fixed mindset believers are just all or nothing. They're like, hey, I actually have tried exercising. It hasn't worked for me in the past, so I never will. Things like that. So number one, you got to be open-minded. Number two, you got to plan and prepare. You got to show up to our check-ins. You got to do at least like 70% of the workouts we tell you to do. And that's basically it for non-negotiables. I'm very into like tracking my habits and then having like goals and then a system of habits to allow me to reach my goals. So I have certain short-term, long-term goals that I've set for myself. And each goal has like a certain amount of habits that I need to do daily, weekly, or monthly in order for me to get to those goals. I have a little habit tracker, so I just do those things. But biggest non-negotiables for me, for my health, is meditate every day, journal every day, move your body every single day. And it doesn't mean intense exercise, but just some sort of movement. I actually like to like play guitar, make music at least 6 times a week. And that just helps me just get out of my own kind of like head and just be in a more creative place and use the other side of my brain. Yeah, I think those are kind of some non-negotiables.
Yeah, they're very effective non-negotiables. So Milad, thanks very much for your time. This has been really enjoyable. Is there any kind of final message or takeaway you want to leave people with?
Well, thank you for having me. This is a great time. Always love just talking shop with you. We've known each other for a while, so it's awesome. Final message, I think the biggest thing is just be compassionate with yourself, with others. Do something nice every day. Move your body every single day and just kind of go from there, you know? That's kind of the secret sauce. And you can be happy. You can be healthy. You're not fixed in space. You're capable of change, and you will change 100%.
Love that. Brilliant. Thanks very much for that.
Thanks, Ross. Appreciate it.